Hello to everybody. Today we have Javier Olmedo from LSU as a speaker, and he's going to talk about the spherical symmetric quantum spacetimes coupled to a thin null dust shell. So Javier, go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you. I want to acknowledge the organizer for allowing me to give this talk, and also to all the audience that is there listening to me. This work has been done in collaboration with Miguel Campiglia, Rodolfo Gambini, and Jorge Pulin. And as you see, it is going to be about the quantization of a self-gravitating cell in loop quantum gravity. So let us go to slide number one. One second. Change. All right. So you can see the plan of the talk. Essentially, I will start with an introduction and motivation in order to why I want to study this model. Then I will go into the classical description and provide the Dirac observables of the model. Afterwards, I will adopt a quantization, a kinematical description with loop quantum gravity in order to quantize the theory. I will provide a scalar constraint that is consistent with the Dirac quantization approach. Then I will provide the quantum Dirac observables. Some of them will be parameterized observables. I will explain what is it, what are they. And then I will discuss the immediate physical consequences of the theory, essentially the singularity resolution. Then I will go into the conclusions, and finally discuss heuristically the dynamics of the system and the future research that we are going to do. Okay, let us go to slide number two. So as you very well know, symmetric reduced models are commonly adopted in order to study at least part of the physics of some given system where the full theory is very complicated. There are several examples where this strategy has worked very well, like for instance the hydrogen atom, where it is not necessary to consider full quantum electrodynamics in order to explain many of its properties. In addition, there are other situations, like for instance homogeneous and isotropic gravitational models that allow us to study or to describe our universe at large scales, where we don't need general relativity, full general relativity. Or there are other situations like astrophysical objects of great interest nowadays, like black holes, that can be explained successfully within axisymmetric vacuum gravity or in a more restricted way within spherically symmetric spacetimes. Although we don't expect that the collapse of a star is going to be symmetric, we know that spherical symmetric dynamics, gravity, has a rich dynamics. It can explain, for instance, the black hole formation after the collapse of spherical matter, and if the collapse continues, the classical GR predicts the formation of a singularity. We expect that within this high curvature region, a quantum theory of gravity will be very relevant. But as you very well know, this region is going to be enclosed within a horizon and will be very difficult to be accessed for external observers. Nevertheless, we expect that black holes will eventually evaporate, emitting Hawking radiation, and therefore there is a possibility that we can finally see what are the main quantum gravity phenomena involved in these situations, especially for microscopic black holes. Within this situation, there is a very interesting problem that can be carefully analyzed within quantum gravity, the black hole information loss paradox. I won't give many details about in this talk, but you can go to the past talk by Abai, where he was discussing the different approaches, where try to deal with this problem that mainly is due to the loss of unitarity at the quantum level, but hopefully quantum theory of gravity will be able to deal with this problem. Let us go to slide number three. So as I said, classical general relativity is very interesting. Let me remind you a work by Chadwick about the collapse of a spherically symmetric massless scalar field. There, if one starts with a given configuration and momentum of the scalar field and evolve the system, there could be black hole formation or not depending on what is the state of the scalar field, that is, the configuration and the energy of the scalar field close to the strong field regime. That is, essentially, roughly speaking, what is happening close to its Schwarzschild radius. So if the scalar field is very concentrated there, or it has a lot of energy, there will be a black hole formation. This black hole formation will be with a minimum mass, so there is a critical phenomena. This, it is described in the picture that you can see in the right side of the of this slide. And of course, if the black hole forms, there will be part of the scalar field that will be scattered into the spatial infinity and part that will collapse inside the black hole. I want to refer for a recent discussion about the dynamics of this model by Nakonietzka and Lewandowski. Also, I want to mention that recently it has been proved by Bojo, Wall, Brahma and Reyes that at the classical level, the Hamiltonian constraint admits an abelian algebra, as in the vacuum theory, so this opens the possibility of studying the quantization of this model in the future within loop quantum gravity. However, we don't know yet how to deal with the quantization of this model, so we will study a simpler situation that essentially corresponds to one of the simplest models of collapse in spherical gravity that corresponds to a thin cell of null dust matter. And it can be understood as essentially the regime of the scalar field corresponding to the lower left corner of this picture. That is the situation where the scalar field is highly peaked and one always have black hole formation. So this model has been studied by many authors, some of them in our community. In particular, you can find people like Corici, Gambini, Pulin. There is a very nice classical description of this system provided by Loco, Whiting and Friedman from 1998. There is also a quantization provided by the authors Hajise, Kiefer and some collaborators that essentially consider a partial quantization of the model. They start with a change of variables at the classical level. Essentially, they choose embedding variables for both the geometry and the shell, and they quantize the latter. So it cannot be understood as a full quantization since the gravitational degrees of freedom are not quantized completely within this description. Besides, the true Hamiltonian rule in the dynamics of the shell is represented as a self-adjoint operator that has eigenstates corresponding to superposition of ingoing and outgoing cells, both with the same contribution. So when one constructs a semi-classical state, essentially this state will be a superposition of what is called black hole and white hole geometries, or horizons. So essentially, when the state evolve, at some point they bounce, they form a black hole, this black hole is suddenly transformed into a white hole, and there is a bounce of the cells. So one cannot claim that in this model there is black hole formations in the times between the black hole and white hole transition are really short. So it will be very interesting anyway to study this model within other approaches, like for instance loop quantum gravity, see whether the we recover the same results so we can give robustness to those predictions, or whether we find alternative proposals. So what the only thing I can advance is that within this quantization we can recover smooth semi-classical geometries with a microscopic discretization, but where the strong quantum corrections appears at the high curvature regime. Okay, let us start with the classical description of the model in slide number 4. So if we start with Astecar-Barbero variables and we impose spherical symmetry and we get rid of the Gauss constraint by changing to or selecting gauge invariant quantities from the point of view of this constraint, we are left with a spherically symmetric connection and triad that has two independent components. The triad and the connection in the radial direction, the ones in the orthogonal one, they depend on the position of the they are fields, local variables. They are conjugate variables, and in addition, we will consider the position and the momentum of the cell that are represented by the coordinates R and P. And there is a, they represent a global kinematical degree of freedom. You can read what is the physical interpretation of the triads. They allow us to codify the components of the spatial metric in line 2. The dynamics of the system is ruled by a Hamiltonian, that is a linear combination of two constraints. The scalar constraint, that is in equation 1, and the diffeomorphism constraint in equation 2. You can find the contribution of the cell in red color. So you can see that in the scalar constraint it is coupled to the geometry. Also there is another new variable, eta, that is essentially codifies the sign of the momentum. It is plus 1 if the cell is ingoing, minus 1 if it is outgoing. So you can also construct or check what is the constraint algebra of the theory in equation 3. And as you can see, it is similar to the one of the full theory where the scalar constraint shows structure functions in the algebra. And this is going to be an additional handicap in order to deal with the quantization of the model. So we don't know yet how to deal with this set of constraints. What we are going to do is to consider the strategy that has been adopted in vacuum. So let us go to slide number 5. There, what we do is to carry out an abelianization of the scalar constraint. So you can see in equation 4 that redefining the laps and the shift at the classical level in that way, we can construct a scalar constraint that is a total derivative and turns out to be or to have an abelian algebra. So you see the total Hamiltonian within this new set of constraints, where we are not modifying the diffeomorphism constraint because it is well known how it is implemented in the full theory. In equation 5 you have the total Hamiltonian. Essentially you can read the scalar constraint in the first line, the diffeomorphism constraint in the second line, plus boundary terms that are necessary in our model. So in the scalar constraint you can see again the, or in the Hamiltonian, the red color contributions corresponding to the scalar, to the cell. In the scalar constraint there is an f of r function. This f of r function depends on the geometry evaluated at the position of the cells. It also depends on the eta variable, whether the cell is ingoing or outgoing. Also in the scalar constraint you can see that there is a theta operator, it corresponds to the standard theta Heaviside. And finally in the boundary terms there is not only the what would be the mass of the cell, but also there is another degree of freedom, the mass of the black hole that would be if we were in vacuum. So essentially this theory will have two physical degrees of freedom, the mass in vacuum of a pre-existing black hole and the mass of the cell. In the following we are going to assume that there is no pre-existing black hole, so we will ignore the contribution of the mass, the capital M contribution, and we are going just to deal with the contribution of the cell. So eventually you can see that if you compute the scalar, the algebra of the constraints, it has the new scalar constraint has the standard algebra with the diffeomorphism constraint and it commutes with itself. Okay, let us go to slide number 6. We can also construct the...
Javier, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
I'm confused about what is the mass of, what symbol is the mass of the black hole and what symbol is the mass of the shell? And how can you tell the two different? I mean, is one of them the ADM mass or...?
The ADM mass will correspond in one asymptotic region to the sum of both, the mass of the cell and the mass of a pre-existing black hole. So if you just turn off...
So let's look at the sector of the theory where there is no pre-existing black hole.
Yeah.
And which of the quantities is not zero and which is non-zero?
Okay.
Capital M. What else is the mass of the shell?
So the mass of the cell will correspond to the red contribution f of r p.
Oh,
the mass of the cell, indeed it's twice the mass of the cell. And 2m is the mass of the pre-existing black hole. So I will just set m equal to 0.
But f of r is a function, right? So why is the mass of the shell a function?
I mean, you can see later that f of r times p corresponds to a Dirac observable. You can check that it commutes with the constraints.
Okay. And the last question was about the coordinate ranges are, so you are not specified the manifold or the range of this canonical variables, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not supposed to think of r as being positive or is going from minus infinity to infinity.
In principle, it can be, we are going to specify both situations where we only have one asymptotic region and where we have two asymptotic regions. So in principle, this treatment is done for the case where you have two asymptotic regions, since it is easier then to restrict to one of them. So essentially, the ranges is from minus infinity to infinity.
But including zero, or is that?
Yes, including zero.
Because if I look at the Cauchy surface in the two asymptotic regions, then r goes from infinity to 2m and then again increases to infinity. But here you are allowing r equal to arbitrarily small values. Is that correct?
No, I don't understand. Can you say again?
Okay. Yeah. So if I look at the eternal black hole, and if I look at the kind of one of the static slices, then the radial coordinate r goes from infinity on the right-hand side, so to say. And as I go inside, it goes to 2m, and then again decreases to kind of, and then suddenly goes again to r equal to infinity on the other side, or r equal to minus infinity. The static slices don't have r less than 2m, is what I'm saying.
But
here you are looking at arbitrary. I'm confused about the phase space formulation and the geometrical picture. So does your phase space formulation correspond to allowing arbitrary slices in the only certain slices, because you have fixed your laps, right?
Well, I don't understand very well your question, but
okay, so why don't you go on, and we'll come back to that at the end if I still have this question. Thank you.
Okay, maybe we can clarify this point later, or if not, we can come back and discuss it again. Okay, no problem. Okay, we are in slide number 6. So we can identify the observables, the quantities that commute with the constraints. Essentially, in equation 7, you have the mass of the shell, which essentially is the function f of r times p over 2. You can check that it commutes with the constraints, both the scalar and the diffeomorphism. And together with this observable, we have another quantity that also commutes with the constraints. And it corresponds to the Eddington-Finkenstein time of an ingoing or outgoing cell. And both quantities are conjugate variables, indeed. So we have the mass and the momentum conjugated to the cell. That is given in equation A, that it corresponds to the capital V. So now that we know the basic Dirac observables, we go to slide number 7, and we can construct what is called parametrized observables. In this case, what we do is, given a phase space function that in principle does not commute with the constraints, what we do is to write it in terms separating the contribution coming from the observables and the contribution of other quantities that are going to be interpreted as pure gauge degrees of freedom. So essentially, they are going to be treated as parameters in the theory. Within this set of possible parametrized observables, we are going to concentrate here to one specific choice, although the description can be generalized to any of them. In this case, we are going to consider Eddington-Finkenstein coordinates that are given by a gauge fixing condition, two gauge fixing conditions. One of them is above equation 9 for K5. Essentially, we write it in terms of observables and the radial coordinate that will correspond later to the EX triad component. Also, it depends on the function that appears up in the numerator, RS, that is essentially the sparse radius of the cell. This RS is indeed a function. It depends on both the position and time. And where by time, this time will correspond to the commoving time of an observer in the spatial infinity. So this choice, essentially, one can see that outside the cell, you will have Eddington-Finkenstein coordinates corresponding to a black hole of mass given by the mass of the cell, but inside the cell it will be Minkowski. So we can, with this gauge fitting condition, fit the laps and the conjugate variable to K-phi, which is essentially a triad E-phi, and finally we can introduce in line 3 another gauge fitting condition for EX to be equal to the radial coordinate to the square, which also fixes the diffeomorphism constraint and the shift function. So within this gauge fitting, if we go to slide number 8, you can find expression for the metric components in terms of the observables. Here I am writing the in equation 10 everything, not in terms of the radial coordinate, with that would be one of the parameters together with time, but since in the quantum theory this ES will be an observable, as we will see later, I have preferred to live in this form. So essentially you can check again that this set of this gauge fixing is giving you Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates outside the cell and Minkowski inside. You can also see that when the cell has crossed the Basel radius and is going into the high curvature region, these coordinates are horizon penetrating. So we can describe both the interior and the exterior of the black hole. So if you plug these metric components in the equation of motion of the cell, and you can solve them in terms of the observables and the parameter, in equation 11 you can see that the position of the cell is a function of the observable B and the time T. So let me just emphasize that this system, this component of the metric in this particular gauge fixing is explicitly time dependent, since the function, the Schwarzschild radius RS, depends on time. Okay, let us go now to slide number 9, and we are going to proceed with the quantization of the theory.
A few questions. Let's go back to slide, the previous slide. So, in this case, now you are completely gauge fixed. Therefore, you must know the what range the parameters, the coordinates take, or the dynamical variables take. So are you saying that R can still take negative values, or R is all only positive now?
Yes, R in this situation can have negative values. As you can see, if I just, for instance, take in equation 11 the time to be equal to the value of V, R is going to be 0, and if the time T is greater than V, it's going to be negative.
Okay, so what is the interpretation of negative R for the shell?
That is just moving into the right, into the left asymptotic region of the space-time. So essentially, you have two asymptotic regions.
Why are there two regions of space-time, right? If I consider a spherical symmetric collapse of a star, for example, I don't have two regions of a space-time.
Oh, right.
One asymptotic region. Right. So why do we have two in this case?
In this case, you can just also study the one asymptotic region, the space-time with one asymptotic region. So essentially, this means that your time will stop when the radius R is equal to zero.
Okay, but if I consider such, so this is not a solution, so this is just a phase space picture. And so you're saying that you just look at to the future, and then it will be like only one asymptotic region. Is that what you're saying? Look at G less than V.
So, no, in principle, this is a solution of the equation of motion, for sure. So the only thing is that you can understand
the classical Einstein's equations. Right?
Yeah, this is classical. Everything is classical. So we are not doing here anything.
You solved the dynamical equations. You have not solved the dynamical equation of the theory yet, right? I mean, you have constraints and you are gauge fixed. So it's like a reduced phase space description, right?
Right. But also you have the equation of motion of the cell, that they are a differential equation that you have to solve. And when you integrate them, essentially you get one solution for R, that is given by equation 11, and of course for the momentum you can just take the derivative of this guy plus maybe some constants, and you get the solution as well. So This is the classical solution. Even when we are working in a kind of reduced phase space description.
So if I was doing a space-time diagram and I looked at a collapsing shell, right?
Right.
Then I would think that, you know, t goes to plus, t should be allowed to go to plus infinity.
Right.
Right? In the space-time diagram.
Uh-huh.
And I only, in the space-time diagram, I only have one asymptotic region.
Right.
So, but in your case, if t goes to plus infinity, then...
Oh, then this is not possible. Indeed, you have to take
so
t equal to minus infinity, that would be the corresponding asymptotic region, and then it is running into the... until it is equal to v. So the range of t can be seen from minus infinity to v.
I see. So v will be like, in the usual space-time picture, t equal to v would be like t equal to infinity, the usual space-time diagram, that Penrose diagram that I'll draw.
Uh-huh.
Collapsing shell.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you. Okay. V is a constant?
V is a constant, yeah. It's observable, it's a constant on...
It's observable, so it's a constant motion. Thank you very much.
Okay, no, you're welcome. Okay, let us go into the slide number 9, and we will deal with the quantization. Essentially, we are going to adopt a standard description within loop quantum gravity for spherical space-times. Essentially, the basic spin networks that we are going to consider are given in equation 12. They correspond to one-dimensional spin networks. They are made out of edges in the radial direction, a collection of edges given by the first set of exponentials, where the valences of the edges are k, j, one per each vertex of the spin network, and they take values, integer values. And together, these edges are going to be joined by vertices that are represented by point holonomies of k phi. The corresponding valences of these vertices is the mu, are the mu's, one for each vertex, and they take values in the real line. For the matter sector, we are going to adopt a standard representation, so we are not doing nothing special here. Then the kinematical Hilbert space is going to be the one given in equation 13. However, since we have found some difficulties, which I will explain later if I don't forget, is that we are forced to restrict the study to the kind of equivalent superselection sector that appears in loop quantum cosmology, that in this case correspond to the mu variable. We have to restrict the study to all those sectors that does not include integer numbers. And you will see later why is this reason. So essentially we are restricting the study to periodic functions of the connection with suitable periodic boundary conditions, in such a way that integer numbers are not included in the spectrum of the mu. So the inner product in this kinematical Hilbert space is given by equation 14. Okay, so just let me mention in equation 13 that L squared corresponds to the Hilbert space of square summable functions of the edges. L square delta j correspond to the square summable function of the vertices, the mu's. Okay, let us go to slide number 10. Here you have the representation that we are going to choose. Essentially you have, this is the representation where the shell acts as a multiplicative operator. The momentum of the shell is standard derivative 1. The triads here are diagonally, and just let me remark, Ex has a discrete spectrum, is an integer times the Planck area, and it will play an important role in the quantum theory since it will be an observable. Classically, this guy represents the areas of the surface of symmetries, the spatial surface of symmetry that essentially correspond to the different spheres that cover the spatial surfaces. Also, the holonomies can be represented in the standard way, the components in terms of the components of the connection in terms of holonomies, that are basically given by displacing the labels of the different valences of the vertices. In addition, we are going to consider a polymer parameter, rho, that is going to be indeed a function if this, or instead of a parameter. So we can choose it differently in the different vertices. So it's just an additional freedom that we are adding in our quantization. And this is not going to be fixed. Okay, so it's a set of free parameters. So let us go to slide number 11. Here we are going to represent the scalar constraint. So the first thing that we do is to construct a discrete version on acting on the spin network of the scalar constraint. So this scalar constraint preserves the number of vertices and edges. We also, as you can see in equation 16, we separated in just the gravitational contribution that will be in vacuum, plus a contribution that is the coupling of geometry with the shell. The geometry is given by the function or the operator f, I, and the contribution of the shell is split in a clever way within this theta and x operator. Theta is the discrete version of the Heaviside theta function that depends on the position of the shell. X is the product in the classical theory of a delta function evaluated at the position of the shell and the momentum of the shell. In addition, we are going to consider a spin network that has a given where the vertices are separated by a distance epsilon. And you can find a description or the form of the operators HG and F in equation 17 in terms of some diagonal operators and other operators that does not commute among them. Essentially, k phi squared, the operator corresponding to k phi squared, 1 over e phi squared, and k phi over e phi. So now, what we are going to look if it is possible to close the algebra. That is, we are going to impose that the constraint commute with itself, and in order to this to be fulfilled, there are several commutators that has to be implemented in the quantum theory. The first one is that HG commutator with F has to be equal to I H bar F squared. So this commutator, if you introduce equations 17 in this commutator, they involve indeed the three commutators that you can find in equation 18. This algebra closes, so this is one of the initial indications that probably we are going to be able to find a representation of this algebra. But it's highly non-trivial to find a particular choice of operator that fulfill this commutator, but we were able to find one. And in addition to these commutators, in B, down at the end of the slide, you can see that also the operators of the shell has to fulfill all those commutators that you can see and all those relations that are down below. Essentially, the theta operator with X has to be equal to a representation of the delta Dirac delta function, this bold delta that appears there. Also, the Heaviside theta operator has to commute with themselves, something that in principle in discrete theories is not necessarily true, as well as the theta operator with the delta function and some other contributions. So if we go to slide number 12, in equation 19, you can
stop a second. So to calculate the commutations in 18, you also need the operators which are the extrinsic curvature operators, right? K hat squared phi and so on. So I imagine that they are expressed in terms of the holonomies?
Right.
But now, the holonomies, you just introduce a parameter just for the heck of it, so to say, this rho j, right? Geometrical in some ways, which was supposed to be x-dependent.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not sure about why the commutators between the holonomy and the EXs, or the E's, the fluxes, will be unaffected by this rho.
Okay. So
if they are affected, then then what exactly is the definition of K-phi in terms of this holonomies?
Okay, in principle, for this quantization, the choice of rho, since it is a parameter, it doesn't affect.
It's not a parameter, right? There are infinitely many parameters.
Well, it's many parameters, but at different vertices...
So why does it not affect? I mean, it should affect, because it depends on J.
Yeah, it's right. But the point is that the scalar constraint, the only part that is, let's say, non-local corresponds in the geometrical part to a diagonal operator. In the matter term, quantities that doesn't see this parameter. So essentially, you can work with a set of parameters and everything is fine. Maybe...
So supposing I just put rho j equal to zero, you're saying that everything is okay?
Oh, rho equal to zero involves that you have, I don't know, it's not well defined, no?
Zero, but sorry, so rho j is just equal to 3 or something. I mean, for all j's, it's not j.
Well,
it's okay.
It's okay, yeah. I mean, from a physical point of view, I cannot say that... Sorry?
So why did you introduce a generality when rho depends on j?
Because you have that freedom, so it's kind of...
I'm not sure you have that freedom because of commutation relations, right? I mean, are you going to use it in a crucial way, or you're just noting
no.
that you could add...
No, you have the freedom, indeed. Even when you have the commutation relation, they are fulfilled independently in the different vertices, so you can choose independently the rows at different vertices. Everything is correct up to the fact that probably from a physical point of view it's giving you physical prediction on the model, but from technical point of view it's okay. One possible difference is that you choose rho to be equal to a phase space function, so it is going to change things. But if it is not a phase space function, it's just a parameter function, everything is fine.
Okay, let's go back. Let's go on, and we'll come back to that maybe.
Okay. So in slide number 12, you have a representation of these operators at the algebraic level. In equation 19, essentially you can see that, for instance, k phi squared, in vacuum, it was essentially given by the sine operators, sine rho k phi rho squared. But in this case, we had to introduce additional corrections, non-trivial factor orderings, and as well, as you can see in the definition of the operator 1 over e phi squared, it also involves non-trivial holonomic corrections. Essentially, this choice allows us to eliminate the anomalies that are coming from the polymeric quantization, from the polymer corrections. In addition, there are another anomalies that appears due to the fact that these anomalies are very close to the one that appears in gauge theories in the lattice, where you know that there is an anomaly due to the fact that, for instance, the Leibniz rule is not fulfilled due to the discreteness of the derivatives. In this case, we were able to handle those anomalies by choosing this representation of the different operators theta, corresponding to a representation of the Heaviside theta in the lattice, x, that is essentially a representation of the operator corresponding to the product of the momentum, that is a derivative with respect to the coordinate of the set, and the representation of the Dirac delta on the lattice, that you can find it given in the right expression of equation 20. So, this is essentially the main technical difficulties that we were able to handle in order to deal with the quantization of this model. So now let us proceed how far we are able to arrive in order to give a quantization of the model. So let me assume that I know what are the observable corresponding to the mass and the momentum. I will come back later to this, to them. But let me assume that I know what are they and I am able to represent them. In addition, if we look for diffeomorphism invariant state, as it happens in the vacuum theory, there will be an additional observable that is emerging in the theory. Basically, this observable that is given in equation 21, it represents the sequence of areas of the spheres of symmetry. This observable has no classical data conservable. Of course, it has a classical interpretation, as I just said, but there is no a classical data conservable corresponding to it. It's a new observable emerging in the theory. So it depends on a parameter, seed, and the number of vertices, n. So, given this observable and the mass and the momentum of the cell that correspond to another physical degree of freedom, we can construct quantum operators corresponding to phase space functions that are not observables. Essentially, they don't commute with the constraints or the transformation that the constraints generate. You can find a couple of examples here, in equation 22 and 23, where the trial in the radial direction is not invariant under diffeomorphism, but we can write it in terms of observables and some parameter functions, as you can see explicitly in that expression. And also it can be done for the spatial derivative of this triad defined on the spin network in equation 23. We can do for this particular phase space function, but if we go to equation to slide 14, you can find the corresponding expression also for the metric components. Essentially, you can see that they depend on both observables and parameters. The parameters are here are x and t, and the observables are essentially the k phi that are in the definition of the operator ex, and not the k phi, the kj, the new observable that appears, and the definition of the ex, and also as I say, the mass and the v observables. So these expressions in 24 involve non-commuting operators up to the time-dependent spatial radius. This operator involves non-commuting observables, essentially the mass and V that appears inside the definition of the Heaviside operator, the Heaviside function in equation 25.
Could you tell us again, remind us what do you mean by spatial radius? I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Oh, yeah. Okay, let us go back to slide number 7. So if you recall, what we did is to consider a gauge fixing condition in Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates that we were restricting the study to this particular coordinate since they are horizon penetrating. So in order to have a description, a geometry, that corresponds to, for instance, let's say a black hole in the exterior of the cell, and Minkowski inside, the right choice is to select this particular spatial radius that depends on these Heaviside functions, one that allows you to restrict the study to one asymptotic region, the first theta x, and the other theta function is telling you that if you are outside the cell, you will have a black hole, a geometry in Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. If you are inside the cell, you have Minkowski. Essentially, because the spatial...
Sorry, if the shell is collapsing the black hole is not... There doesn't have to be a black hole, right? And because you already said there is no pre-existing black hole.
Right. So
when you say there's a black hole geometry, what do you mean? I mean, there is no black hole geometry.
No,
black hole geometry is only after the collapse has completely occurred.
Black hole geometry, I mean in the exterior of the cell.
You just mean Schwarzschild.
Schwarzschild, yeah.
There's no black hole, there's just Schwarzschild geometry. I don't know what is R sub s. R sub s in Schwarzschild geometry, R Schwarzschild radius is just 2m.
Yeah.
That's not what you mean.
Yeah, right. But you have to take into account that the cell is evolving and it can transverse the spatial radius and go into the interior of the black hole.
Schwarzschild radius, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm
asking an elementary question. What is the definition of Schwarzschild radius for you?
The spatial radius by itself is 2gm, where m is the mass of the cell, right?
Okay. So then why don't we just write down Schwarzschild radius Rs to be equal to 2gm? This is the question that I'm wondering.
So at some point when the cell is evolving, the cell will arrive at a given radius which corresponds to 2gm, right?
Right.
And if it continues evolving, it goes into the black hole that the cell has created with its own mass.
Right.
right? So if you are in, imagine that you are in a position in the cell that is very close to the singularity. So these coordinates are giving you the, what I say, black hole geometry. Essentially, you will have the exterior, the horizon, and the interior of the black hole. And since they are in Edmonton Finkelstein coordinates, they are black, horizon penetrating. So you can go inside the horizon. In other words, you can cover one of the asymptotic regions of the space-time within these coordinates. The difference is that
Let me ask one last time. If I don't understand, then we can just go on. You have a collapsing shell, right?
Right.
And that collapsing shell, however, has a mass. And are you saying that that mass is changing in time?
No.
Okay. Therefore, the Schwarzschild radius is just 2gm, and therefore that is just constant in time.
Right.
It's just a constant. There's nothing more than that.
Nothing more than that.
Equal to 2gm, right? I mean, that's it. Whether the shell has collapsed or not, RS is just equal to 2gm.
Right.
So why do we have this? Why don't we just write RS equal to 2GM instead of having all the things on the right hand side?
Oh, because essentially we were like, maybe the notation is not very good. It's just a matter of compactifying the.
You have something in mind which is not clear from the notation.
Yeah, right. Okay. The notation is essentially we introduce, you see, this function RS that it will be like the Schwarzschild radius. At least it codified the information of the Schwarzschild radius inside. Okay? However, it of course depends on time and depends on x. In such a way that the geometry that you are describing is like a Schwarzschild in the exterior in Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, in the exterior of the cell. In the interior of the cell is just Minkowski.
Okay, so, all right, so it's a function on the phase space that you're describing, which has this property. So we should not think of it as Schwarzschild radius. It is just this characteristic radius such that outside the geometry Schwarzschild, inside is flat.
Right.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah?
Right.
Okay. Good. So we can go to 14 now.
Okay. So we are in 14. So essentially what we do here is take that particular choice of observables and represent it in the quantum theory. I mean, just writing the corresponding, identifying what are observable, what are parameters. But I insist that this is done for a particular system of coordinates. This description indeed can be generalized for any other choice that you can imagine. If you prefer to work in a different coordinates, I can just construct the corresponding parameterized observables in those coordinates and quantize them. So this is the idea. And also we can provide a representation in the last line, equation 26, for the position of the cell in terms of observables and parameters. So, okay. What is the difficulty that we have found? Essentially, in equation 15, we don't know how to represent yet in the polymer space, the mass and the volume of the mass and the momentum conjugate to the mass as a Cefa-joint operator. So essentially, we are still working on this, but in order to see what are the physical consequences, although they are not going to codify all the polymeric corrections, we hope that the main or the most important ones are going to be codified in this quantization. What we do is to adopt a standard representation for the mass, M and V. So essentially we can choose.
In principle you cannot do this, right? And because mass is positive. And this was another question that I was asking before.
Right. You are right.
R. So this, same thing is true with radius R. That cannot be the R and P sub R cannot be self-adjoint, and similarly mass and its canonical conjugate objects cannot be both self-adjoint.
Yeah, I agree with you, but you can do, for instance, the following. Either you can use this representation and restrict the study to highly peak state that has positive mass, so that you can neglect the negative values of the mass in that sector. This is one possibility. The other possibility is, instead of quantizing this algebra that appears, the commutator that appears up to equation in the third line, at the beginning of the third line, you can represent, instead of translations in the mass, you can represent dilations in the mass.
and therefore this will guarantee that you will have a positive mass. So these are the two possibilities that you can adopt. Is that okay?
You said third line of what, sorry?
The third line in equation, in slide 15. You see that there is a commutator, where I say, however, we still can adopt a standard representation for the commutator M, B equal to I, H bar. So,
okay.
This is what I say that, okay. So, let us assume that we are in the standard representation. We are going to restrict the study to positive masses by selecting a sector of the of quantum state. There, the physical inner product is given by equation 27. And now, let us try to do a bit of what is the physics, what is behind of this model. Let us consider a spin network among the physical ones. One of them that has a particular, it has radial position, the vertices are situated in a lattice of a given radial coordinate, such that we are considering here that we cover the two spatial asymptotic sections. We can restrict the study to one of them, there is no problem. This is telling us that essentially the position of the vertices will be separated by a distance, delta, capital delta. It is going to be the discretization of the geometry. It can be chosen extremely small. Indeed, it can be smaller than the Planck length in certain position of the spin network. And within this particular state, we can represent parametrized observables. Essentially, the trial in the radial direction is going to be this x I squared times just x y squared. The radial derivative of the triad is given by the expression that you have in the last to the last line. So essentially we have well-defined operators. We can also represent the metric components within this spin network and find corresponding expression, expectation values, whatever. But within these assumptions, you can see that essentially the corresponding effective geometries in equation, in slide 16, you can see that the within this assumption, the corresponding effective geometries are essentially equivalent to a discrete version of the classical theory on a lattice given by a corresponding spin network. So there, if you consider that the number of vertices is huge, is so large that we can cover a big portion of the whole space-time, the corresponding geometries will be smooth. We'll have a microscopic discretization, of course, and they will appear strong fluctuations, or the discretization will be very strong, close to the high curvature regime. However, we can even make this geometries even smoother by considering, for instance, superpositions of the mass and these sequences of the spheres. If we do that, we get smoother geometries, but on the other hand, there will appear, what we expect is going to appear is high fluctuations in the high curvature regime. So essentially, in that regime, we cannot represent the geometries in terms of smooth semi-classical geometries, but still they are going to be regular. And the reason is that the singularity can be solved in this situation as it is done in the vacuum case. There, we have to take into account the following fact, is that the scalar constraint doesn't mix different values of the labels corresponding to the case, the label of the edges that codify the information about the areas of symmetry. And in addition, there are observables, parametrized observables, that the requirement of self-adjointness introduce restrictions to the possible values of this case. Essentially, the smallest k cannot be equal to zero. So these arguments allow us to restrict the study to those spin networks that has no vanishing case, and this is mainly the reason why there are no singularities and the geometries are regular in this quantum description. So this is basically the main physical consequences of this quantization. Let me go to slide number 17. I will just read the conclusions, and in equation 18 we will discuss a little bit the dynamics and other aspects of the quantization. So essentially what we have done here in summary is that we have provided a quantum scalar constraint that is compatible with the Dirac quantization approach, at least at the algebraic level. We have not been able to find the solutions to the constraint yet. We haven't studied them. We don't know whether they are going to be fine in closed form. We can identify parameterized observables and construct among them the metric components in terms of these Dirac observables. We don't know a Cefalioni representation for some of the observables, in particular the mass and the momentum of the cell. But if we assume in a standard one, we can complete the quantization and show that the quantum theory is singularity free. In addition, we can construct semi-classical geometry that has a fundamental discretization at the microscopic level. The geometries are smooth away from the high curvature region, but there are important corrections at that regime, where close to the singularity will be. And finally, in equation in slide 18, I would like to discuss a little bit the dynamics from the quantum dynamics from an heuristic point of view, and then I will discuss which is the future research that we are going to do. So essentially, let me assume that I have a topology with two spatial infinities. We know, or at least to my knowledge, the canonical loop quantum gravity is not able to deal yet with dynamical change of topology. So once you choose a topology from the very beginning, this is the topology that you have. So if you choose a Minkowski spacetime that has a little hole somewhere and you can cross into two different spatial asymptotic regions, and you put this hole in the center of the spherical symmetry, the cell, if you evolve in time, the cell will collapse, will form a black hole, will cross into this little hole, and will emerge in the other side of the spacetime, leaving behind a white hole. So this is one possible picture, and this is very easy to implement in this quantum theory. The other more interesting one, perhaps, is the situation where you have only one asymptotic region, so that if you prepare a state corresponding to a cell that is collapsing, the cell will collapse, will form a black hole, but whenever it arrives to the high curvature regime, in particular to the smallest vertex, we haven't studied yet the dynamics, the full dynamics in detail there. So we don't know whether the cell is going to bounce, whether if it bounces it will evaporate the black hole or not. So all these questions we haven't been able to understand very well yet. So essentially one possibility for the cell bouncing in this particular model is to introduce a kind of boundary condition that the cell has to go back when it arrives into the smaller vertex. As I say, this is just a speculation. So, just to conclude is that we are going to try to find a Cefalioni representation in the polymer space of the corresponding observables, see if we are able to find also the solutions to the constraint that will codify also important information about the dynamics of the system, and eventually, if it is possible, it will be very interesting to deal with the problems of what are the typical times of evaporation of these black holes, and finally, what is going on with the black hole information loss paradox within this framework. So that's it. Thank you so much.
So time is open for questions.
I think I would like to understand your slide 15 better, or 15 and 16. I still don't understand what is the key point about singularity resolution. So can you explain it without all the, I mean, in some conceptual terms, and then going to the details about all the xi is equal to I plus 1, etc. My main problem is that xi are all just some coordinates, and we should talk about singularity resolution in terms of observables. Or,
right.
If you can just explain to me
conceptually
what is happening, why there is singularity resolution in the high curvature region, or why everything changes in the high curvature region.
Okay. So the idea is can be explained easily. You realize that essentially you have spin networks that, in principle, at the kinematical level, you allow to have some of the k's can be equal to zero. In principle, the kinematical structure is allow you to do that.
Again, what k is physically mean?
K is the value of a corresponding sphere. So if you go, for instance, to let me see a slide number 10. You see the representation of the spectrum of the triad EX that essentially codifies the radius of the spheres is proportional to KJ times the Planck area. So this K, if it is zero, essentially means that you have a sphere that has zero radius. And it can be interpreted as a
15, right?
Yes.
You have got E sub E X, E super X, that I understand.
Uh-huh.
And you have an argument little x. And on the right-hand side, I don't see any argument little x. So can you explain why is there an argument of little x for E hat x? And on the right-hand side, nothing depends on little x.
Oh, right. No, but at this point, I'm just talking about, I just say that in terms of observables, EX is proportion, the spectrum is KJ, basically. Okay?
Okay, so I can forget about that argument. I mean, it looks like E hat of X is evaluated X, and I don't understand what that means in quantum theory, but maybe you can...
Oh, yeah, because essentially in the kinematical framework, you have a spin network that has position in a given fiducial manifold, the Ryan manifold. So essentially when you evaluate EX, it's an operator that is not an observable, it depends on the position. However, when you go to the quantum theory, the spectrum of these guys that is codifying the spin networks, the sequence of k's, is an observable of the theory.
Okay? So this little j on the right-hand side refers to the point at which the triad is evaluated.
No.
In other words, the x in the argument of E hat x corresponds to j in the...
Right. You can understand X as J, essentially, right.
Delta X, X, J.
Where in the... No, it's okay. No, there is no missing... No. So essentially, yes, X, J is going to J.
Translated to J on the right-hand side. That's what...
So essentially, when you are working with physical states, the position of the vertices disappears. Because you are working with different invariant states. So that's the physical state doesn't depend on the position. However, when you are going to give a calculation, you have to somehow choose a fiducial structure, the parametrization of the state, something like that, in order to make calculations. Otherwise, you lose interpretation. Right? It's like, for instance, when you work in loop quantum cosmology, that you have to choose an internal time in order to make computation and see the evolution. Otherwise, you are working with an abstract theory and you lose interpretation with. So something similar, we have to do this in this physical state in spherical symmetry. But you still codify the physical information in the case. And you don't want one of the cases to be zero because it will involve that you have a singularity. So in order to get rid... Sorry?
Yeah, we can go to 15 now.
We can go to 15 or 16. Well, 15. There, here is not explained in detail, but essentially the singularity resolution is given by the two following arguments that are not given in the slide. It is in the papers in the vacuum case, but I will just mention what is the idea. The idea is that the scalar constraint doesn't modify this case, so essentially they are observables and are not modified by the scalar constraint. They are not modified by the diffeomorphism constraint. So whatever sequence of code you have is going to be that forever. In addition, this is not an argument enough, because you can, for instance, consider restricting the study by hand to all those spain networks where any of the k's is non-zero. That's fine, but you are restricting by hand to that particular situation. An additional argument that allows you to restrict the study to this particular set of a spin network where no k is equal to zero is to require self-adjoiners to do some of the parametrized observables. This was explained in the paper originally by Gambini and Pauling in the vacuum case. And essentially, this requirement of self-adjoiners allows you to get rid of those spin networks, physical state, where one of the k's can be equal to zero. And this is the arguments that are behind the singularity resolution, that can be applied also here.
Okay, so let me understand. So it looks that, just to see if I understand what you're saying about what is done and what are the gaps, right? So in the vacuum case, self-adjointness was critical to say that this value k sub j doesn't arise.
Right.
And the second, k sub j equal to zero does not arise. And the second important thing is that somehow you've got this quantum observable, new quantum observable that you found, out of the Gambini and Pauling found, O hat of z, which has no classical analog, and its eigenvalues are j's, k sub j's.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, those, since it's a Dirac observable, that is what you're using to say that whatever k sub j is just remains and doesn't, and that's why if it's not zero, it's just never zero.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Is that what is?
Right.
These are the two essential arguments, right, that went into the previous, namely that there is a Dirac observable.
Right.
And because of that, k sub j is kind of don't change in time or they're
right. Observables. Right.
Mm-hmm. And the second one is that self-adjointness says that the k sub j equal to zero is not in the
right. That's essentially right.
And that is what gave rise to the singularity resolution.
Right.
Whereas now in your case, it is true that there are some gaps about self adjointness of the full set of observables that you should really consider.
Right.
As you're saying. So that is a gap at the moment.
Yeah.
And again, going back to the vacuum case, it was also, I mean, in some sense, since this observable doesn't have a classical analog, would it be fair to say that in that sense we don't have an intuition for why the singularity is resolved? Right? Because there's a Dirac observable, and that Dirac observable doesn't seem to exist classically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, classically, of course, you know, even if singularity does arise, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I mean classically, r equal to zero is always allowed as
right.
a point. But the area of the shell never, and when it becomes zero, then there is a singularity.
Right.
Like classically. Right? But classically, it does happen. So therefore, the radius of the shell is not, or there is no Dirac observable which will prevent it by. Which will tell us that, in fact, the singularity cannot occur, because it does occur classically.
Mm-hmm.
But quantum mechanically, there is a Dirac observable which has no classical analog, and that is letting us conclude that the singularity does not occur. And therefore, we don't really have a good kind of intuitive understanding of the singularity resolution in this particular case. Is that a fair statement, or are we missing it?
You can try to find an even more rigorous proof that there is no singularity resolution, but from the point of view of the self-adjoiners and the observable, I think that even when we are missing, there is a gap, as you say, with some of the observables are not known in the self-adjoint representation. I would say that even when you adopt the standard representation, you, even in this case, have a singularity resolution.
Right, but in both cases, so for simplicity, let's not worry about the gas and
okay.
Let's go to the vacuum case.
Okay.
So So even in that case, I would would it be fair to say, and I mean, maybe Gambini or Pullin or anybody else can answer this. Would it be fair to say that even in that case, in some sense, we don't have a full understanding of the singularity resolution because there's a quantum phenomena, there's a quantum observable, a quantum Dirac observable, whose
right.
existence is critical in the to the argument, and it has no classical analog, and therefore we don't have an intuition for that.
Well, yeah, from that point of view, I will agree. Yeah, that if it's somehow it is, the emergence of this observable is surprising because we haven't seen something like that in other systems. So, but yeah, probably we need to understand deeper. Everybody, no, not only us, but everybody, what is going on with this new observable and what is the role in the singularity resolution and everything. At least from a physical point of view, technically I think it's more or less clear, but from a physical point of view, yeah, I agree that something...
But I mean, the point is that since it's such a quantum observable as I think no classical analog, it will be difficult to construct even some sort of classical equation, right? I mean, some effective equation or something which will tell us mm-hmm. what is happening,
Yeah, in this sense... there is a paper that I have seen recently by the one I mentioned at the beginning by Bojewar, Brahma, and Reyes, where they discuss in one of the appendices the implementation of the diffeomorphism constraint, and they comment also about this new observable. And essentially, if I'm not wrong, probably they can clarify everything, anything, or if I say something wrong, that please correct me. But they say that this observable appears in the quantum theory, but whenever you construct effective theories coming from corresponding physical states, in the effective theories there is an emergence of the new constraint that makes sense about the interpretation of what is going on with the classical theory and the quantum realm. So in the end of the day, when you have a local effective theory, it appears that no additional degrees of freedom are present there. But I haven't go into the details, so this is just the main argument that I got when I read the paper. So maybe they can comment something, or I don't know.
Okay. So last thing that I wanted to ask was about maybe if Param is there and if he has any comments about this result and the results that he has found about what happens in the. In the Kandowski-Sachs model that you were commenting on last time.
But I'm not here.
Any meaningful comment that you know, that can should give us some insight or intuition or whatever?
So, but I'm not here.
He's not here. Okay.
No.
Okay, thank you.
So any other comment or question for Javier or in general? If not, we can thank the speaker again.